What up, super friends? Isela here. No rapping for me. Last time I tried that, I got strangely misogynistic. Sorry, getting off topic. In response to the really kind people who've reached out asking how they can support us, we've set up a Patreon. We're so legit now. One might say we're too legit to quit. We know subscriptions are sucky, but we've made it super easy to sign up. And best of all, it is dirt cheap, y'all. Only $2 a month. You can't even buy a single Savage Smoked Slim Jim for that money. For $2, you'll get our episodes a week early and ad-free. Also, we're going to send you some fun and cool stickers a few times a year, along with a shout-out during one of our episodes. You will be known to us as the most super of our super friends. Link is in the show notes, or check us out on patreon.com/technicallyaconversation.
Trigger warning. This episode includes the topics of suicide and suicidal ideation, depression, and a gross overuse of the word morbid. Listener discretion is advised. L'appel du vide, or call of the void, is a strange, uncharacteristic phenomenon one feels to put themselves in imminent danger, like the urge to jump off of a building or cliff when looking over the edge, or swerving into oncoming traffic while driving. Most people never act upon this urge and affects those that have never had any suicidal tendencies or thoughts, but is so common that 1 in 3 people will experience this. Today, we'll discuss what is the call of the void, what research has been done to study it, and people's different experiences with the sensation on this week's episode of Technically a Conversation. Greetings, you're listening to Technically a Conversation, a podcast where we share an interesting topic or story with each other and hope you find it interesting as well. I'm one half of your host, Jose, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-host, Isela. How are you doing today?
Absolutely fabulous. How are you?
I'm doing great also, thank you.
Good.
I'm sad to report that there is not a lot this week when it comes to Taylor Swift conspiracy theories, but there was a picture that circulated on Twitter last week of Travis Kelce wearing a shirt that read, "Trump won," which received more than 1 million views and 22,000 likes. Did you hear about that?
I did not. This is heartbreaking, unless he was saying it ironically as a joke.
Yeah, it was an innocent enough looking picture. Him and Taylor Swift were holding hands, and it looks like they were walking like near a pier somewhere, and he was just wearing a white t-shirt that said "Trump won" on there.
Oh, wow. He's spreading that fake news.
Well, before you burn your Kelce jersey and steamroll over all your Taylor Swift paraphernalia, the picture was a fake and was a doctored photo from Elle, where Kelce was wearing a plain white t-shirt, but it did make the rounds for a little bit until the source was discovered.
Interesting. That's really good that somebody fessed up or somebody found the true undoctored photo. Excellent.
Yeah, it's pretty slim pickings right now on Taylor Swift. Maybe once the Super Bowl kicks off again, people will get excited about it, or excited enough to spread conspiracy theories. But yeah, as of right now, not much.
Yeah, but who knows if they'll still be together by then. I don't know. Not that I want that to end. That sounds really shitty of me. Never mind.
Isela's like, I want Taylor for myself.
No, not at all. Nope. She's pretty, but that doesn't really work for me.
There was a conspiracy theory that maybe like a month ago that they had broken up because Kelce had removed Taylor from his Instagram and she had removed him. But I guess it warranted like a press release where Taylor Swift came on and said, yeah, we have not broken up.
Oh, wow. God, it got around to her. She had to be like, everybody's okay, people. Mommy and daddy are still together.
Yeah, but people are real serious about it. And we're real serious about bringing these conspiracy theories to your ears as well. And What was the term we said about stimulating the algorithm or whatever, or coercing the algorithm?
Coercing the algorithm. That's what we're going to do. Hashtag, let's do it. Oh, yeah. That actually works with the last episode.
Yeah. All right. Enough fucking around, Isela. Ready to get started?
Yes, sir.
Great. Let's get started. Okay, today we're going to talk about something that's really fucking weird, which in itself is not weird because at least half of our episodes are pretty weird.
Yeah.
The thing about today's topic is that according to some studies, which we'll discuss, a shocking amount of people have reported having this sensation. When I describe it, immediately you're going to think that only someone that suffers from depression, suicidal tendencies, or mental illness would experience this. Mm. But the thing that makes these thoughts unique is that the people who have reported experiencing them have no prior history with depression or thoughts of suicide. People with no known mental disturbances who would otherwise be considered to fall within the spectrum of normal, in other words. In fact, this is so common, the French have a term for it. So dust off your AP French 101 book, Isela. Are you familiar with the term l'appel du vide?
The beauty of what?
L'appel du vide.
The vide of life? What is it? I don't know.
Sacre bleu.
Oh, blue, something blue, sacred blue.
No.
I'm just kidding. Tell me.
So have you ever had a thought that's so dark and morbid that you almost feel ashamed or scared of having it, although you would never act upon it?
Is it like when people jokingly say, oh, if I hear that person's voice, I'm going to kill myself, but they don't mean it? Like that kind of thing?
I guess that can kind of maybe fall within this. Let me go ahead and explain it to you and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
The following is from a Life Science article by Joe Fellin and an All That's Interesting article by Kara Goldfarb. Links in the show notes.
Show notes.
Have you ever stood on a balcony enjoying the view and had the unexpected thought that you could just jump? Maybe you're standing at the edge of a cliff, looking at the river below you, and consider how easy it would be just to step over the edge. Maybe you're scared of heights and would never put yourself in such a situation. While driving down the road, have you ever had the thought of how there's nothing really stopping you from driving headfirst into an oncoming vehicle or jumping straight into a car at a busy intersection? These aren't the thoughts of someone with mental disturbances. It's believed that 1 in 3 people will experience one of these thoughts. It's so common that the French have a term for it, l'appel du vide, which translates to the call of the void. These unanticipated thoughts are usually out of character and are usually nothing to be worried about. But why do they happen? And what do studies reveal about people who have experienced this? Now, before we examine the research, Isela, are you familiar with the call of the void?
I am, now that you gave that perfect explanation. Yeah, absolutely. I have been in a high place and thought, oh, wow, like it's so easy for somebody to just jump over this tiny, short, you know, whether it's like a fence or something. I remember thinking that's like really crazy. And then one of my very first coworkers at my first job, she told me that she can't take, so there's a road here for super friends that don't live in El Paso, and it's called Trans Mountain. So it goes straight through a mountain. And she would say that she can't go through Trans Mountain because she was afraid that she would just like, it's too easy for her to like, just, I guess, run off the mountain or something. And I was like, well, you got a steering wheel. Like, so I kind of understand it. But at the same time, I mean, just as like a fleeting millisecond type of a thought. Yes.
Yeah, I think your friend is more on the point itself, because it's not really just having a thought of like, oh, how easy it is for me to jump off. It's more of having like the urge when you look down of maybe wanting to jump off. And it's something that's out of character. It's not something that you normally think of. So before we go too far, I do want to make the distinction between a sudden, out of character thought of putting yourself in imminent danger and having obsessive thoughts or fantasies of self-harm. If you fall into the latter group, I would recommend that you contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 if you feel you need to talk to somebody or whatever the crisis lifeline is in your region. What we'll be discussing is the common phenomenon of experiencing this feeling in a completely non-suicidal way. And it's common enough that some studies have been dedicated to it.
Mm.
So you mentioned thinking how easy it is to jump off of a building.
Yeah.
But have you ever felt like you've been drawn into doing it? And maybe like the thought came into your mind, even if it was just for a second?
I don't know if I would say I was drawn into it, but when I was thinking like, oh my God, this is so short of a like a fence type of thing, I remember thinking even what it would feel like you could just hop over it. But that was probably as far as it went. It wasn't like, I'm going to do it. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just like, oh, but sometimes I feel like maybe I have like a fear of heights where I'm like, oh, like I don't want to get too close. Not because I think I'm going to jump, but I'm like, ooh, I feel like someone's going to be a jerk and actually like accidentally like push me and I'm going to get all scared or something. Then I'm really going to have a phobia. I don't know.
No, I kind of have a bit of a scared of heights too. So I don't think I would put myself in that predicament. If there's like a balcony or something or like a rail or something that I can approach, I might approach and kind of look down, but look down towards the distance, but looking just like directly below me, that like automatically, I guess like triggers like the fight or flight response or something. And I move the fuck away.
Do you get dizzy? Like that whole, almost like you almost get like a vertigo?
I've never gotten dizzy. No.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But yeah, it is enough to me. Like, I don't know. I almost call it like having like an inverse boner where like you feel like it becomes an innie. Like that's kind of like the sensation that I get when I look down. Like it's almost like they're getting sucked into the body or something.
Well, you know, it could be your body that's like preparing itself for any type of trauma, because when trauma happens, the blood tries to pull around your heart so that like when people are dying and they're like, oh, you know, it's cold, like their extremities are cold. It's because their blood is trying to pull around like just their torso. So it could be like preparing itself. Like you could actually be feeling that. That's wild.
Yeah, that probably is what it is. And I know that I don't like the way that feels. So I don't try and put myself in situations where I feel that.
Right.
But I can admit that I felt the call of the void when I'm driving. Especially like if I'm driving on a road where it's like one lane going north, let's say, or going one direction, the other lane coming in the opposite direction, where sometimes you'll be like, you know what? Nothing is stopping me of just swerving into the other car and just ending it all.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, Jesus, take the wheel. Right?
And for me, that's not a characteristic thought that I have, despite how morbid I am. I do have a very high self-preservation mechanism that kicks in.
Yes.
But it is a thought that I've had. And I've always thought it was just me being morbid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if I'm like really close to where a train is, I live like maybe like 2 miles from the train tracks. So sometimes I'm like, fuck it, man. I'm just going to gun it right here. And of course, I don't do it. But
right.
I always thought it was just me being morbid, but it was the call of the void.
That's fascinating that many people have that, one out of three.
Yeah. So what we'll go ahead and do is we'll talk about some of the science behind this, and then we'll talk about some examples that people have reported on the internet. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm for it. Let's do it.
The first person that really began studying this phenomenon was Jennifer Hames, who led a study at the Department of Psychology at Florida State University and was published in 2012 in the Journal of Affective Disorders. The study sample was 431 undergraduates being asked if they had ever experienced this phenomenon, all the while assessing their mood behaviors, symptoms of depression, anxiety levels, and their levels of ideation. And ideation is kind of like mentally storyboarding an idea. You come up with a concept or idea, you develop it, and you include any possible outcomes. Something that's real popular right now on the internet is people and their revenge fantasies. That kind of would be an example of ideation, where you think about, oh, if I'm going to get revenge against this person, this is what I'm going to do. And this is going to be the ice cream I'll be eating while getting revenge on them or whatever.
It's almost like elaborately thought out or something.
Exactly. 1/3 of the participants of the study reported that they had experienced the call of the void before. People with higher anxiety were more likely to experience the phenomenon. She also discovered that people with higher anxiety were more likely to have higher ideation. So the theory is that people with higher ideation are more likely to report experiencing this urge. A little over 50% of those that reported feeling the call of the void stated that they did not have suicidal tendencies. Of those that had lifetime suicidal thoughts, 75% reported experiencing the call of the void. You would kind of expect those with suicidal thoughts to experience this, but the interesting part of the study is that over 50% of those that had felt the urge never had suicidal thoughts. The study determined that there was a clear difference between an individual imagining the possibility of placing themselves in imminent danger and wanting to act on it.
I think that's really, like you were saying, it's counterintuitive. If you're not depressed, why would that even be a thought? Like even a fleeting thought, but still, why would that even be a thought? But I mean, I guess I've kind of had something like that too. Like I was saying, like I could almost even imagine like grabbing the railing and like just, I'm like, yeah, that would be really easy. But I think it was more like a fascination on like how easy it was, but I could almost feel it, like mentally feel it in my body, like jumping over, you know what I mean? But, and I'm as happy as they come. Like, trust me, I feel like give me any situation and I'm going to try to find the silver lining out of it. So I do find that counterintuitive, but easily believable because I guess I've kind of had that in at least once.
Well, I'm kind of glad that that's what you answered, Isela.
Uh-oh.
Because Hames concluded that the call of the void in those with high ideation might be a person's subconscious attempting to encourage a greater appreciation of what it feels like to be alive and could indicate that someone has a higher than average degree of sensitivity when it comes to experiencing and interpreting internal cues as opposed to their mind wanting to lure them to their demise. So in other words, people that experience the call of the void, it's kind of like the subconscious mind trying to make them appreciate how much they enjoy living.
I think that's even more confusing because I feel pretty grateful already. Like I really honestly do. I don't know. Maybe my subconscious thinks I'm not grateful enough. Like you are not at the right gratitude level. I don't know.
Or maybe it's like, yeah, appreciate what you have and what you experience and don't even think about doing it.
Right. Yeah. That's so interesting.
Because just the fact that people that experience it are people that have high ideation. I think they're people that are not necessarily more creative, but they're people that are more imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier for them to imagine what it would be like for something like that to happen. So maybe that's why they're more susceptible to experiencing the call of the void.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. That's awesome that there's even been studies on it.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised too.
Yeah, it seems like something not a lot of people would want to necessarily fess up to.
I first discovered this. They were talking about, I don't remember what the topic was, but they were talking about it on the Daily Zeitgeist. And both of the main hosts, Jack O'Brien and Miles Gray, they're both fathers. And they were talking about how delicate a baby is. And they were talking about the soft spot on a baby's head. I think it's called like the fontanella or something like that. And they were saying that sometimes I get the call of the void and want to touch it, you know, even though they know that they shouldn't.
Oh, no. Oh, I've never had that with a baby. Oh, wow. That's scary.
And I think if I had a kid, I would kind of want to touch it too, even though I know that you're not supposed to. Like it's very bad, you know, but there's really nothing that's protecting the brain from damage aside from skin, you know?
Right.
So that's how they came upon the whole call of the void discussion. And I was like, you know what? I kind of want to see if that's true and see if there's any scientific research behind it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did it on this because I mean, I didn't know that there was even a term for it.
I would have not known either had they not talked about it.
There was, I don't know if it was Radiolab or This American Life, but they talked about how dogs had this. And you would see that dogs, if they took them hiking and stuff, sometimes they would jump off of cliffs too. But some dogs do have it. It's not that dogs are suicidal. They're not like, oh my God, this owner doesn't give me enough treats. I gotta go. But dogs also have this, whatever it's called.
Yeah, I have heard about that. And there are some bridges that are pretty famous for dogs jumping off.
Yeah, multiple times. Like the same dog will do it. Yeah, multiple times. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I just Googled it real quick. It's called the fontanelle. It's the soft spot. I think I called it like the fontabellum or something. I can't even remember what I said.
I think you're just calling it fontanella. But yeah, the fontanelle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that is really, really interesting. I think dogs might be a little bit harder to study just because you can't ask them what the fuck went through their mind. But
yeah,
That is a very curious occurrence.
Agreed. Very weird.
A 2020 study published in the journal BMC Psychiatry by Tobias Thiesman from the Department of Clinical Psychology and Psychotherapy at Ruhr University, Bochum, in Germany, wanted to investigate if Call of the Void was more prevalent in people with suicidal ideation than those with no suicidal ideation, as some people who reported experiencing Call of the Void were concerned that it could signal something more troubling about their mental state. So he was kind of concerned that maybe people that experience this more is maybe people that might be more suicidal.
Yeah, I could see how that could signal, like, this is the yellow flag on the play. Like, hey, hold on, time out. Let's investigate if somebody's feeling, you know, really true depression.
If somebody wants to go in for the first down.
Oh, last down. Oh, sad.
I don't know. That's the only football term. And I think I know like the 5-point conversion or whatever, but I don't know what that means.
The 3-point. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
So Thiesman recruited 276 adults who probably knew more about football than I do, who filled out an online questionnaire, and 94 participants who had a clinical fear of flying and had sought treatment to overcome this phobia. Thiesman also found that those who had reported suicidal thoughts were also more likely to experience Call of the Void, but he also discovered that those who reported experiencing Call of the Void were more likely to react to body signals anxiously. In other words, people who experienced shaking, dizziness, or muscle twitches were more likely to recall the phenomenon than people that didn't. Thiesman concluded this phenomenon affects people regardless of suicidality and anxiety, and as such is normal and not a sign of psychopathology. In other words, people shouldn't interpret these experiences as an expression of a hidden death wish.
That's fabulous to know.
Yeah, definitely, especially since I've experienced that. And Thiesman even admitted to experiencing Call of the Void while he was in his 20s, so he was particularly interested in studying it. So now that we know what Call of the Void is, let's take a quick commercial break. And when we return, we'll talk about some people's personal experiences with this phenomenon.
Ooh.
Hi, I'm Abby, and this is Alan.
Hello.
We're from the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast, where we explore the history of horror and modern horror storytelling.
We do deep dives into legends like ghost trains or the Headless Horseman or Wendigos.
Available wherever you listen to podcasts,
including cell phones and computers.
Join us on the Unseen Paranormal Podcast as we dive into the history, hauntings, and how strange of the world to try to better understand the paranormal. I will be your guide. I am paranormal researcher and investigator Eric Freeman Sims. Tune in to the Unseen Paranormal Podcast for new episodes every Wednesday as we welcome authors, historians, researchers, investigators, and various other guests to explore our unseen world and the unexplainable. All current and past episodes are available anywhere you get your music or podcasts. And remember, some of the scariest things are unseen.
Hello and welcome to Myth Monsters. I'm Erin, a self-confessed mythology addict and occasionally scholar. Myth Monsters focuses on the monsters of global folklore and mythology, with sometimes a cryptid thrown in once or twice. We go from looking at jackalopes, to gorgons, to wendigos, to Bigfoot, from dwarves to elves, and honestly, everything in between. Why should I listen to this podcast over any other mythology podcast out there? Well, we're only 15 to 20 minutes long, so we're perfect in time for your little commute. And also, we focus on a different culture and monster every single week, a real in-depth look into modern media, where they're found in films, TV, video games, and books, and also the origin, description, and if I believe they existed. So it's perfect for any short trips or if you're into any specific monsters that you fancy. So come join the fun every Thursday and stay spooky, babes.
And we're back.
We're back.
Did you have any uncharacteristic thoughts of putting yourself in imminent danger during our break?
None, thank God. I'm happy to report.
What do you think of the phenomenon and two of the studies that have been done on this urge?
I think it was really important that somebody did a deeper dive to see if there was like a correlation between depression and this thought. But like I said, I'm glad to know that there is no correlation because it happens to such a high number of people. Like 1 out of 3 is, that's a lot of people, you know? I think, you know, it's the same amount of people that, I don't know, that are probably...
flossing every night?
Yeah, there's only 1 out of 3 people flossing, yeah. Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, like I said, I know I guess I've kind of had that thought, but not, I mean, but like a very fleeting, like really quick thought, like, oh, but not because like, oh my God, it was never from a thought of, oh, my life sucks or anything like that at all. Like, I think I have won in the lottery of life, like for sure.
Yeah. And for me, I also was relieved that it doesn't correlate with suicidality because, you know, like I said, I usually have a lot of morbid thoughts. So I have thought about that before. And I've wonder if I'm like secretly suicidal and, you know, maybe I need to get help or something. But I just realized that I am a very ideation focused person, I guess.
I would love to know more on why it is that these people, you know, is it like, are we more creative types? You know what I mean? Like, is that what's going on?
I think because you're able to, like I said, just storyboard an entire scenario. When I was a kid, I would have fantasies of being in a band and I would imagine, you know, going to the store and buying a guitar, practicing with my band, going out on tour. But yeah, I mean, I think you have to have a certain amount of ideation to do anything creative, you know, when you come up with stories, with song lyrics.
Right.
You have to have a certain degree of creativity, you know, to think of things as far as like a structure, a beginning, middle, and conclusion.
Yeah.
So I think that if you're that type of person, you're probably more imaginative and you could actually imagine all those crazy and morbid things that you have in your mind, you know?
Right. But the weird thing is, I don't know if I would even consider myself creative, but I could definitely, I don't even remember where the hell I was, but I remember thinking like I knew what it would feel like, the width of the fence that was in front of me, like underneath my hands, like everything, you know? But I was like, oh, that was a weird ass thought type of thing. But I can't say I've really considered myself creative. Like, I don't write songs. I don't draw. I don't, you know, I was a business major. That's why I have 2 degrees in business. You know, maybe on my nails, that's as creative as I get.
It's still creativity, you know?
Sure. Yeah. No, I'll take it. I mean, I've always wanted to be a creative.
I think with me just being stuck at home so much when I was younger, you know, I know that people are sick and tired of me talking about it, but we weren't allowed to do anything when we were kids. We were pretty much stuck at home. So sometimes I would just lie in my room and just imagine what it would be like to be outside and ride my bike with other kids or, you know, whatever, just like mundane things, but things that I didn't really get to experience. So I don't know, maybe it developed from that. Who knows?
Yeah, could be.
But yeah, I have no problem coming out with like super elaborate scenarios of stuff.
That's very interesting.
I have a hard time forming a complete sentence, but forming complete and elaborate scenarios in my head, no problem. That's probably also why I never get bored.
I'm the same way with sentences, don't worry. But I think that has more to do with we might be thinking both in English and Spanish and we're trying to convert or translate things so quickly that sometimes it takes a while for our brains to catch up or our motor skills, our actual mouths to catch up.
And I think just my brain and my mouth are not connected, so.
Mostly, that's mine.
Yeah, it takes a while for the brain to get down there.
To spit it out.
Exactly. Talking about spitting it out, before I forget, sometimes you'll hear people refer to this urge as high place phenomenon or HPP, but they are referring to Call of the Void. Personally, I don't like this term too much because you don't have to be in a high place in order to experience the urge. You might feel it when you see a train approaching and you have the urge to jump in its path, or when you see a vehicle approaching and you have the urge to drive into oncoming traffic or jump in front of a vehicle. Hell, I play around with a lot of electronics. In my past life, when I would be fixing a computer or a guitar amp, sometimes I would wonder, what would happen if I touch this exposed wire or if I insert this screwdriver right where the fuse is?
Oh my gosh, have you really? That's scary.
Of course, I've never done it because I'm not suicidal, but
yeah,
the thought has crossed my mind.
That's so funny. No.
And the urge is also a common term to describe the sensation or the phenomenon when referred to call of the void, because you're really getting called into this void, I guess, and it's the urge of being called towards it.
You know what? It's almost like how we're dying to know what's in a black hole, but we would literally die to know, obviously, right? Like we would get stretched and torn apart or whatever, but we are dying to know, like, this is what we want to, you know, we want to get in there. Like, what is in that? And it is like a void. Like, this is like this nether area that we don't even know.
Yeah. Or maybe another more relatable experience would be when you're out in the field and then you hear like some type of engine above you. You look up, a light shoots down, and you get drawn into the space shuttle. And then you wake up 2 days later and wonder what the hell happened to you.
So relatable. Classic, classic Martian move.
But I just imagine that, like, you know, getting sucked in the... I imagine that's like the call of the void.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't move. You're like, but I want to go, but I don't want to go. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that would be like one of my wishes for that to happen. But sadly, it hasn't happened yet.
You never know. Maybe that's in store before your 50th birthday or something.
I've only got a handful of years left, so better happen quickly.
Yeah, a boy can dream, I'm sure, for you.
Let me play some people's accounts of their experiences with this urge. The following is from a Medium article by Laura Cooper. And she describes one of the most common experiences of Call of the Void. I'll have AI read it, since I suck at reading and no one wants to hear me stumble through her experience.
Okay.
The first time I recall experiencing the Call of the Void was when I was traversing the footbridge across the lake on my university campus. On my daily walk, I often experienced an urge to throw either myself or my mobile phone into the lake, and I wasn't the only one. My friends on campus reported experiencing similar feelings as they crossed the lake. The urge has never really left me, it seems. Only this afternoon, 20 years after those initial feelings were first recognized, I experienced the same urge whilst sitting on the edge of the harbor in the city where I currently live. I watched the boat's gentle rise and fall, observed a cormorant dive down to feed, and wondered whether I might find myself making a similar journey myself. My legs turned to jelly. Good thing I was already sitting.
So aside from no normal human using the words whilst and traversing,
yes.
What did you think about her experience?
I thought it was really interesting that she said she wanted to throw her mobile phone in the water too. Did you catch that?
I did.
I think that's almost suicide of a different kind. Like, there's social suicide. Here it goes. That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever had a thought of tossing any of my electronic devices from a high place, but I feel like that might be a cry for help for her, maybe.
Believe it or not, I have the mobile phone inflicting damage on my phone more often than I'd like to admit.
But I think that's only because you edit our podcast. You're like, oh, damn it.
No, it's not even that. Sometimes, you know, I'll be somewhere like, I'll be like on the roof and I'm like, I can just drop this fucker right now. Let's see. Let's see how good that Gorilla Glass is, you know?
Oh my gosh. Now you're part of the testing team.
Yeah. Of course, I don't want to spend $1,000 on a new phone, so I don't do it. And I hold on to my phone for like 4 years. Until the back pops off from how bloated the battery is. But
yeah, like your last one, it was getting puffy. It was the pink puffy, but it wasn't pink puffy.
No, it was the black puffy.
It was the black puffy pelvis. Yeah, oh, no, that's not. But yeah, the black phone. Yeah, that was really interesting to see. I was like, what is happening? It's morphing.
I felt dangerous because I felt like I was taking my life in my hands with that phone because it was so distorted from how puffy it was. I was like, this fucker could blow up any moment now.
you were it was your own little death wish on the side.
It was my personal call of the void every time I carried my phone with me.
or like my hip is going to possibly explode.
Now, Laura Cooper goes on to explain Call of the Void and some of the research and her relief in finding out that this is a normal experience that many people report having. So I took that part out since we've already talked about all that. But I know what you're thinking, Isela. You don't even have to say it.
I want ice cream.
Well, I guess I know what your second thought is then, because...
Just kidding. Yeah.
And the reason I know what you're thinking is because I thought it too. Has anyone ever given in to the Call of the Void? Of course, we're morbid, so we want to know this. Has anybody actually gone through with it?
Of course.
This was Redditor Billa Papa's experience.
Uh-oh.
Was super low point with depression, driving, and swerved into oncoming traffic momentarily. It was late and not a ton of cars on the road, so I think I was in the other lane for a second or two, when I heard horns, and the horns reminded me there were other people I'd hurt. So thankfully, I was able to swerve back and go on about my life as if it hadn't happened. God. I felt terrible about it, but I think about it a lot when I'm driving alone and will always resist the void now, thankfully.
I would imagine there are more people than that. I hate to say it.
There are definitely more people than that that have experienced it. There was one guy that he was talking about how he jumped in front of a train pretty much, but he came to his senses and he came out of it. Personally, I don't think that these really count because, especially with the example that we just heard of Billa Papa, he or she, I'm guessing it's a he if it's Billa Papa, I think it would be Billa Mama if it was a she. But
of course, that only makes sense. Yeah.
But Billa Papa reported being depressed. And normally when you experience the Call of the Void, you're not depressed. But you can kind of see how someone who's going through some shit might give into it.
Right.
And I think the same for the one that I was saying about the guy that jumped in front of a train. I think you're probably going through some shit if you give into it. I don't think that's normal Call of the Void. I think that's suicidal tendencies at that point.
Yeah, at the very least, somebody had a bad day or something, and then, you know, you get that double whammy action, and yeah, no good. Now it's something different, though, like you said.
Yeah, that's definitely no good. And if you do feel that, 988 is the number you want to dial if you're in the U.S.
Yes, please. Everybody deserves to be here in life.
Yeah, and it does usually get better, except for that time that it does. Well, no, actually, that's a bad joke.
Depends on who gets, if someone gets reelected, then there's a problem. I'm just kidding.
Oh boy. Yeah. Yeah, that'll be bad. So I know what you're thinking, Isela. Jose, you're OCD. Well, yes, I am definitely in the OCD spectrum. What about somebody that has OCD? What is their experience with the Call of the Void? Well, I don't think that it's something that I fixate on, but we can learn from Mark Wester's experience from his Overcoming OCD blog.
Oh.
I had my first Call of the Void experience a couple of years ago when I was walking across a bridge. I'd have a sudden thought, literally out of nowhere, what if I just jumped and threw myself into the river? To people who do not have OCD, this sudden urge wouldn't cause severe distress, but to me, this was the beginning of a new obsession. I had a terrible feeling that was more than just a simple urge. I really felt like I could just jump into the river at any single moment. It all felt so real. And I used to ask myself, what if I actually want to jump? What if one day, I will lose control for a couple of seconds and I will do it? I think I do not want to die, but what if I do? How can I ever know? And it really felt like a never-ending story with all the typical what-if questions familiar to every OCD victim. And obviously, it was not only about the disturbing thoughts, but I'd start avoiding any situation that could trigger my fears. So, during those dark days, I'd never ever cross a bridge or I'd never smoke a cigarette on the balcony, and in the most extreme period, I never actually dared to open the window cause I'd been terribly afraid of jumping out of it. This happened years ago, and I can say that nowadays, I'm doing just fine. It was a very long and difficult journey and I'd not have been able to do it alone. I was lucky to have very supportive friends and family.
Weird that you had, well, at least the first half of his story, you had the same thing that you were talking about where you started questioning like, oh shit, am I depressed? What's going on here? Oh, that's so funny. Did you hear the similarities in that?
Yeah, I don't want to say that I'm OCD, but I'm definitely on the spectrum. There are some things that I'm very OCD about. When I encountered his story, I was like, I can see how one can become fixated on those thoughts. And in this person's case, it was maybe like to the extreme where they just totally became fixated on it. And he, I guess he kind of allowed it to take over his life a little bit. I mean, I don't want to say that he like allowed it, like he gave it permission, but it just was something that happened. It's something that happens to people that are OCD. They sometimes can't really help it.
I think because it sounded like he was questioning his own feelings, where he didn't know, is this some kind of weird subconscious thing that I do actually want to die? And remember how he was kind of saying that earlier? Then it almost sounded like he was, if anything, taking extra precautions to not smoke a cigarette outside and stuff like that, which I think that's really fabulous. Like, if you know that that thought can cross your mind when he was feeling particularly low, then yeah, look, don't even give that an opportunity to be like, oh, you know, like some weird urge to take over.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's when I guess like something like OCD becomes a problem, is when it starts interfering with your life and you start changing things because of it. I don't think that I've ever really gone that far. I think some of the craziest stuff that I was OCD about was if I left the air conditioner on when I left, or feeling that I might not have locked the door. So I would go back and check it like 3 times, feeling that I left my stove on. So as far as air conditioner and lock, I have a smart lock and I have a smart thermostat. So at any time I can check on my phone. I don't have to drive all the way back from like Phoenix or wherever the fuck I am to to check to see if I did lock those. The stove, that's another story, but that one I kind of just have a little bit of faith, I guess, if you can say that.
And it also helps that you never cook, so that's great. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
90% of the time I don't cook.
I'm kidding. No, you have an air fryer. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, that is something that I don't want to say that I became fixated on, the thought of it, but I did start wondering if I was maybe suicidal and I didn't know it. And then I started wondering, do other people have these crazy ass fucking thoughts that I have? And yeah, it makes me feel better that 1 in 3 people do. 1 in 3 people are as crazy as I am.
And the weird thing is if you would have told me, or if I would have told you, I don't know who would have been brave enough to bring it up first, we could have kind of smashed this whole like idea, like, oh no, yeah, other people do have this. You know what I mean? And I've known you for years now.
Yeah.
Many years. A decade almost, you know.
Yeah, I think it's been longer than a decade now.
Probably. No, I think you're right.
And if you do have OCD and you find yourself being called by the void, you might want to check out Mark Wester's website, which, again, like everything that we discuss, it'll be in the show notes. For some helpful tips on overcoming this sensation and this. More than anything, it's more of like this obsession. But he does talk about how he faced his fears, relied on family and loved ones for support, learning about it, and ultimately accepting and making fun of it.
Oh, that's really great. That's wonderful. That sounds like a good tool.
Yeah. And he talks about multiple experiences while being OCD and, you know, like those type of things that trigger you, how he's learned to overcome them. So he does give a lot of helpful tips for, you know, whatever your OCD is, maybe he might talk about it and talk about how you overcame it.
That is very cool.
Any final thoughts?
No, it's good to know that, you know, I wasn't the only one. And even though it was, I don't even know when the last time that happened, it was many, many years ago. I can't even remember where the heck I was, but I remember being in, it was a high place in this particular instance. It wasn't like you had mentioned, like oncoming traffic or anything like that. Yeah, that's so weird. That's really interesting. It's good to know.
It is definitely a very crazy concept. And, you know, again, it made me feel better knowing that I'm not alone in having these weird thoughts. And again, 1 in 3 people experience it. So I think that's, you know, pretty normal, I guess, you know, if it's something that so many people experience it.
Also, what is normal anyway? You know, I feel like normal is a fallacy in itself.
True. I think there's a spectrum of what would be considered normal behavior, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
I know that I'm definitely more morbid and dark than most people. And I know that I have a very morbid sense of humor. That's probably more than most people. But again, there's not a correlation between that and Call of the Void. So
yeah, no, I think that was one of the things that you and I, like, our humors line up a lot, because I would make like bad jokes, which I would say, like, you know, in air quotes, bad jokes. And we would laugh. So I was like, oh, yay. He does get me.
Yeah, it's very hard to offend me. But yeah, it's not very often that I meet somebody like you that we can laugh about like the most fucked up and heinous things.
I know. Yeah. Yes, takes a special elite of us. I'm just kidding. And hence our super friends who've stuck with us from day one, probably. I know we've made some morbid jokes for sure.
Definitely. I can guarantee it. Now, something that's not morbid is after doing the Pappy Heist episode, I've had a couple of super friends reach out and ask me what kind of whiskey I like or what I thought of a whiskey that they enjoyed. So I thought that I would copy Richard Campbell from Windows Weekly a little and start giving a whiskey pick or a recommendation.
Very cool.
So if you're at all whiskey curious, I highly recommend that you check out Windows Whiskey, which is a playlist on YouTube that has all the whiskey recommendations that Richard Campbell has made. And it's really great because he goes into the history and always tells a story. And most of them are maybe like 8 to 10 minutes, so they're not very long.
Oh.
They take out just the whiskey part out of the Windows Weekly episode. So that again will be in the show notes. And honestly, Richard Campbell is my Yoda, and I really look up to him, his knowledge and his love of the history of dark liquor and his recommendations. So I know I said it on here before, but I really started getting into whiskey back in October. I've always enjoyed it and I always enjoyed the history of it, you know, especially when Richard Campbell began talking about it in June of 2023. My story was that I was a craft beer drinker, and Isela, talking about knowing each other for a very long time.
Yep, yep.
Isela actually got me into craft beer.
Yes, sir.
So thank you. Prior to meeting Isela, I actually didn't drink. So she's been an absolutely positive influence in my life.
You're welcome. Yeah. Your liver hates me, I'm sure.
Absolutely positive influence. Now, I would have the occasional drink at a party. And of course, I drank when I was in high school and college. But I pretty much quit drinking around 2005. And we met, what, like in 2011 or 2012, around there?
Yeah.
And that's when I decided to take up the sport again.
Yes. The way we do it, yes.
Yep. Fast forward a few years and I got into IPAs, and that was the main beer that I enjoyed drinking. And to this day, that's still my favorite. Around October of 2023, I was getting a lot of gout attacks. So I knew that I had to cut down on my beer drinking. I wasn't drinking a ton, but I was having 2 or 3 beers a day to unwind and relax after work. I did some research to see if whiskey was okay to drink, and everything said that gout sufferers should abstain from alcohol altogether. But if you insist on drinking anyway, whiskey is less bad than beer. So I kind of saw that as a glowing recommendation.
So it didn't recommend stuff like vodka because it was a clear, less sugars. I'm assuming it's like a sugar thing, no? Or what is it?
Maybe not due to the carbohydrates in the potato from what it's made out of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Honestly, I think vodka tastes awful. So that would not be something that I would abstain from drinking alcohol altogether if vodka was my only option.
Nobody wants that. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
But I said, well, I can't really drink beer. I wonder if whiskey is less bad. And it turns out that it is less bad.
That's wonderful. Okay. And you found a really, like a whole other world of whiskey. Oh, great.
Yeah. A whole other world, a whole other community.
Yeah.
So I started revisiting all the high school classics. Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, Crown Royal, Chivas Regal, Johnny Walker, Maker's Mark, etc. And I discovered that I preferred bourbon over all other whiskeys. So I started watching review videos and making lists of bottles people often talked about. And I discovered some of my personal favorites. Old Forester, Wild Turkey 101, Four Roses, Elijah Craig, Buffalo Trace, Woodford Reserve, Old Granddad Bottled in Bond, 1792, Very Old Barton, etc. So I have quite a list.
Nice.
And the more that I enjoyed a whiskey, the more I got into the history and started going down all those rabbit holes on YouTube. Now with the whiskey club that I'm a part of, we try a bunch of different things, and I've discovered that I really do, in fact, like scotch too, more than I remembered liking as a kid.
As a kid, oh my God, scary.
Well, when I was in high school.
I know.
So my pick this week will be a scotch just because it's time sensitive, possibly. It's actually Glenmurray 100 proof rye cask finish. And Murray, it's spelled M-O-R-A-Y. You kind of want to say Murray, but everything that I've seen, they always call it Glenmurray. So that's what I call it too.
Yeah, very cool. All right.
The box says that it's a limited edition and it's a U.S. exclusive. Glenmurray sells a rye cask finish as a curiosity edition worldwide, but that one is only 92.6 proof. As a result, I can't find much information online about the 100 proof U.S. exclusive. Everything links back to the curiosity edition. Now, there's no age statement in the U.S. exclusive, so it has to be aged at least 3 years. The curiosity edition appears to have been aged 4 years, so I'm guessing it's around the same for the U.S. edition. There's not a date on the box or bottle, and I couldn't find when the U.S. edition was released. But the Curiosity Edition came out in 2021, so I'm guessing it's the same for the U.S. exclusive. The bottle and packaging look almost identical. Now, I paid $37 for the bottle, but I see that it's gone up to around $50, at least in my area. So the supply might be running a little low. That's why I said it might be time sensitive. But again, you can literally find nothing on the U.S. version of it. It is a Speyside single malt. So it's really sweet and fruity. And if you're not a fan of peat, you're safe with this one. I don't detect any smokiness at all. But it does have a bit of a rye kick, which I personally like. It's also 100 proof, so that's going to make it a little hotter than most scotches. And for $37, it's definitely a buy. For $50, I personally would still buy it, but I would have to change my recommendation to try it first. Maybe see if your local bar has it. If you try it and like it, let us know.
Yeah.
Some other popular Speyside scotches, just to kind of get an idea of like the flavor and everything, would be the Glenlivet, Glenfiddich, Macallan, and Belvini. So you kind of know what to expect a little bit. Glenmurray isn't as popular as those other well-known brands, but it's not a new kid on the block by any means. The company was founded in 1828 as the Elgin West Brewery and made local ales for the Speyside region of Scotland. They switched to being a whiskey distillery in 1897 that was made entirely of local barley. They're kind of known for aging their whiskey in a bunch of different bourbon and wine casks, including port, sherry, and Chardonnay casks. And I had read that they made one in Manzanilla casks and that it tastes amazing. So I definitely want to find that and try it.
Manzanilla being chamomile, right?
Correct.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. How cool.
Yeah. And Manzanilla is... It's like a Spanish tea. So it's apparently it's put in casks and they age it in those casks that the Manzanilla is put into, which I had no idea that that was done, but apparently it is. And apparently it's an amazing tasting scotch.
Yeah, I could imagine how it gives it a good flavor.
Yeah. And kind of like uncharacteristic for Speyside scotches, they also do make a peated scotch that I also want to try since I do enjoy smoky whiskeys a lot. And even though they're a more economical brand, their stuff is pretty good. They pride themselves on being single malts, so they're not blended scotches. They're single malts, and they're not diluted with grain alcohol like other brands do.
Mm, all right.
So I thought that was really cool. And again, you can find it for $37. I highly recommend it.
Very awesome. All right. I like this.
Yeah. Thought I would try something new and maybe bring out some more whiskey lovers in our community.
Yeah. If people are already asking. I mean, clearly some... You have the attention of some whiskey lovers. Sweet.
Yeah. So special shout out to our super homie, super friends, Sophia, Natasha, Eric, Angie, Eli, and Madtown Charity.
Charity. Thank you guys so, so much.
If you want to be super cool and help support the show, get the episodes a week early and ad free, get your name shouted out on the show, and get some stickers from us a few times a year, check us out at patreon.com/technicallyaconversation. Or check the show notes. Best of all, it's only $2, baby. You can't even buy cigarettes for that.
Much less scotch.
You can definitely not buy a bottle of Glenmurray, single malt scotch whiskey, rye cask finish, 100 proof for that. It'll cost you several months worth of your patronage.
Yes.
On that high note, we hope that you enjoyed the show and you join us again next week. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a review. Tell a friend and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Follow us on the socials at GreetingsTAC. Email us at greetingstac@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 915 317-6669 if you have a story of your Call of the Void to share with us.
Oh, I definitely want to hear that one.
And don't share your blue balls stories like Isela suggested in the last episode.
I know. Sorry. I do regret that a little bit.
Very bad idea. Don't do that.
Yeah. Or the poon pangs. We don't want to hear poon pangs either. We get it.
On next week's episode of Technically a Conversation.
Eurovision, often dubbed as the Super Bowl of Pop, is an annual song contest where countries from across Europe and sometimes beyond compete for musical glory. Eurovision began in 1956 as a way to bring war-torn Europe together through music. The roots of Eurovision trace back to the aftermath of World War II, with the aim of fostering unity and reconciliation among European nations through the universal language of music. The inaugural contest in 1956 featured just 7 participating countries, each presenting 2 songs. Since then, it's grown into a global phenomenon, captivating audience with its eclectic mix of pop, rock, and everything in between, with over 40 countries now vying for the coveted title each year. It's a spectacle unlike any other, blending over-the-top performances, catchy tunes, and enough sequins to outshine a disco ball.
New episodes drop Monday. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a show.